Kimberly McCarthy is a prisoner. If Texas has its way, she'll be dead within the hour. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where Texas is preparing to carry out the 500th execution of the modern era by injecting McCarthy with a deliberate drug overdose designed to stop her heart. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will broadcast live coverage and commentary on the killing in Texas, the state responsible for more than one-third of all U.S. executions. Execution host Ray Hill, legal analyst Jim Skelton, with criminal defense attorneys Susan Ashley, Larry Douglas, Mike Gillespie, and Jack Lee. Huntsville reporters outside the death house Gloria Rubeck and Professor Dennis Longmire. Houston visual reporter Dave Atwood. The execution watch for Kimberly McCarthy begins.
And good evening, this is Ray Hill. I am the host of Execution Watch. I want to point out that there are a couple of things exceptional about tonight's program. Kimberly McCarthy will be the 500th person executed in Texas since the Furman case, which stopped all executions in the United States, and the states went back to the drawing boards, rewrote the laws, and started executing again. Texas began executing with Brooks, who was the first person that we executed way back in the 80s, and we have continued at an even pace. In spite of the fact that it was just announced that the governor of Texas is going to in the name of pro-life, call another special session of the legislature to end any possibility of a woman having an abortion, he was not so adamantly pro-life when he signed the death warrant, which is required of him for Kimberly McCarthy, who's being executed tonight. I'll leave it to you to figure out that dilemma. This is the 500th execution, and in gathering statistics for that, I discovered that the year with the largest number of executions in Texas happened in the year 2000, when then Governor of Texas George Bush was George W. Bush was running for President of the United States while being Governor of Texas, and some of us felt that he was trying to prove that he were the alpha male suitable to run the baboon troop that is known as the United States. And everyone knows that the alpha male in any troop of baboon is the one that kills most of the others. We have on the telephone Dennis Longmire, who is reporting from Huntsville. Professor, are you there?
I am here. I'm sad to say I am here.
And is there a goodly crowd there on the occasion of the 500th?
There is. It's hard to estimate crowd at this side because the media gets intermingled with the protesters. There are about 100 of us here on the corner. Most of them, I'm going to say 90%, so let's say 90. People here are opposed to the death penalty with signs, and they're chanting. Gloria Rubeck, who is usually your reporter, is leading the chants. Actually, just as you made your phone call, the witnesses for the media began walking across the street, and now I'm seeing witnesses for Kimberly McCarthy walking across the street. And so for our listeners who aren't familiar with what that means, it means the execution is about to proceed. Kimberly McCarthy is now what they call rigged and ready. She has the catheters in her arm. Now all she's waiting for is for the witnesses to get into their places and for the governor to, or for the warden of the unit to give the signal for the execution to begin.
Are there a large number of witnesses?
There were a handful of people who went in just now. I'm going to say there were five of them. I didn't recognize any. I don't know anyone affiliated with the case, but I believe five witnesses went in after the media went in.
Dennis, you're a professor of criminal justice at Sam Houston State University. Is that not true?
That's correct.
And you are a regular attendee of these executions when you don't have a conflicting class.
That's correct. I have been here for 90%, at least 90% of the 500 that we are now in the process of carrying out. I also count others because I also have been here on the happy occasion when an execution actually gets stopped.
Mm-hmm.
So I've probably been here 500 times, maybe more.
Okay, Dennis, we appreciate your support, and thank you very much for helping us here on Execution Watch.
Thank you for your service.
Thank you. And now we go to Dave Atwood, who is in... David, where are you?
Well, we're down in the Museum District, Ray, corner of Binns and Main, and across from the museums. And this is where we're going to be I guess this will be the last execution scheduled in June. Then we move to a different location.
Okay.
But this is where we are today. And it's a lot of traffic. And we have a good turnout. I think we have 25, 30 people here, which is much more than normal. We've had some good press coverage. We've had people come out today that don't normally come out. And quite frankly, it's very, very hot out here. But I'm sure it's just as hot up in Huntsville.
It's the hottest day of the year so far.
Excuse me?
It's the hottest day of the year so far.
Yeah, wouldn't you know it?
Yeah.
Good turnout.
Dave, do you have any
visibility?
Do you have any comments on number 500?
Well, I think it's a horrific record to think that we've had that many executions over the years since 1982. It's a low spot in the history of the state of Texas. I'm sure people will look back on this day and. And I don't know how many will come after this, but at some point, you know, we see death sentences, executions go down. So we're going to get rid of this horrible death penalty at some point. We're not there yet, obviously. And today's a very sad day for everybody. It should be a sad day for everybody in the state of Texas that we're still doing this at this time in history.
Well, how do people get in touch with your organization, Dave?
They get in touch with, probably the best way is to go to our website, which is tcadp.org, tcadp.org.
TCADP is the shortened acronym for Texas Coalition Against the Death Penalty.
To abolish.
Texas Coalition to abolish the death penalty.
That's our goal. Our goal is nothing short of abolishing it totally.
Take those first letters and add .org and it works. Dave, I appreciate your vigilance. Give our regards to the other vigilants there with you.
Okay, we'll be right. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. And now we go back to Huntsville because David Rizicki, who is of KPFT News Team, is up there covering the occasion of the 500th execution. David, thank you for joining Execution Watch.
Thank you.
What is your view of the response and turnout up there?
It was a very good turnout. A lot of vocal people. Had a loudspeaker here with a microphone giving their opinions. There's a lot of, I would say 99.99% were against the death penalty. I talked to one guy who was a little bit more pro, death penalty, but he didn't go that far to say he was. He was just more conservative in his views.
Okay. David, have you had any experience covering this kind of event before?
No, I haven't. This is my first time, actually.
Okay. Well, you'll find that the community of activists kind of hang around KPFT, and if you stick around here, you'll meet most of us.
Okay.
Okay, and thank you very much for helping us cover this event.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And that was a new voice on Execution Watch, David Rizicki, who you can hear covering stories for KPFT Evening News. Who's going to tell me what happened in this case?
I'm just going to volunteer.
All right, that. Jim, take it over. Jim Skelton has served the role as both prosecutor and defense lawyer, and he beat a wizard to help other lawyers do their trade. Jim, what happened in this case?
Well, first off, this lady, Kimberly, McCarthy was a 36-year-old woman who lived in Dallas and obviously had a terrible, terrible addiction to drugs. And around 4 o'clock in the morning, she goes to her next door neighbor's house. This is a 71-year-old woman by the name of Dorothy Booth, who is a retired professor, and went over there under the pretense of borrowing a cup of sugar. Now, this is from the state.
At four o'clock in the morning, a cup of sugar.
And she went over to borrow a cup of sugar and ended up stabbing this lady, Mrs. Booth, like something like five times and hitting her in the head with a candelabra and then using a meat cleaver to chop off her ring finger to steal her diamond ring. So it's a real gruesome case, and they killed her. And after the murder took place, she stole Mrs. Booth's purse, the ring, of course, and Joe stole Mrs. Booth's Mercedes. And the evidence, she never confessed to it, but the evidence that tied her to the crime is that she went from there to a pawn shop when it opened up and hawked the ring, and they identified her as one that hawked the wedding ring, hawked it for $200. When she got that money, then she goes to a crack house and buys crack drugs at the $200. And then she starts using the credit cards that she took from the purse. So they had her connected to the ring, connected to the credit cards, plus they arrested her driving the Mercedes car that belonged to the victim. And then to kind of add more to it, they knew she was stabbed to death, and they did DNA testing on the butcher knife found in Mrs. Booth's house, although it had been cleaned up. They did find the DNA evidence both from Wimberly McCarthy and Mrs. Booth both. So she was tied in through DNA evidence, through having the property as a result of the murder. Her first trial, she was convicted by a Dallas jury and given the death penalty. That case was later reversed based on the fact that they admitted a statement. She gave a real bizarre statement to the police. She claimed the two guys, one named Kilo and a guy named J.C., had been at her house doing drugs. They ran out of money, and they wanted to find somebody to get some money from and to buy more drugs. And they claimed that they convinced her and threatened her to call a neighbor. That's why she called Mrs. Booth. Her story was initially that all three of them go to her house and knock on Mrs. Booth's door. Mrs. Booth answered the door. The two men pushed themselves in and threw her outside. And she claims the two men did the killing and brought all the merchandise they stole out of the house and gave it to her. Problem is, the defense lawyers who tried to defend that never could find any indication that these two guys ever existed, somebody named Kilo and somebody named J.C. And what happened, the Court of Criminal Appeals, what had happened in that case, when she gave the confession, she invoked her right to counsel. They continued to question her. Therefore, that statement should not have been admitted. And although she didn't actually admit participating in the murder, it would have made her guilty as a party to a crime. They said that was enough to harm her, so they reversed the case. They retried the case without the statement, and another jury in Dallas gave her the death penalty. You end up having 24 people thinking she's guilty. And this case, it was real difficult for the lawyers to try to get out of not saying she's guilty, because they put the stolen property in her possession. They could tie her into the ring. They had her in the victim's car, had her using her credit cards, plus the DNA evidence. And guilt was almost assured in this case. There was very little doubt about guilt.
Is there any indication that either the prosecution or the defense ever found any other parties?
No. No, and in fact, the defense lawyer said they tried and tried to find these two mysterious men, but to their knowledge, they could never find them. Of course, I doubt seriously that the state did much serious looking for them, but the defense lawyer certainly did. But there's no indication of that.
It wouldn't have changed her lot in life had they found them, right?
Not at all, because then she'd been a party to capital murder. Now, they might have been, if they could have proven that someone else did the killing and she set up the robbery, that might have avoided the death penalty in this case. Because really, the truth of the matter is, when you look at this case, it all boiled down to the issue of punishment. It all depends. It's one of the, what we call a punishment case. So I've asked Susan to go over all the punishment evidence, because that really was the meat of this case, is the evidence introduced at the punishment hearing.
Susan, what happened in this trial?
Okay. Well, at punishment, there were two other murders came in at punishment. There were two other elderly women that essentially she robbed and murdered. There was one elderly woman who was an 82-year-old woman. She was a longtime family friend. She had helped organize McCarthy's wedding and allowed her to store some furniture at one time at her house. This woman was stabbed several times. It was a pretty violent, brutal attack. And there was apparently the murder was accomplished with a meat tenderizer, like a meat I guess you'd call it like a hammer, a tenderizer hammer.
Ooh, yeah. Well, I've seen those things. They look
okay. Anyway, and then this lady's purse was missing from the home. There was another elderly woman who was an 85-year-old woman, and she was physically handicapped. She was a distant cousin of, I guess, McCarthy's mother. She was found. She was stabbed. She had a lot of violent wounds, a lot of same type of thing, a lot of blunt trauma to the head and neck and face. And the injuries were consistent with a claw hammer that was found near her body. Also, the contents of her purse and wallet were missing. She had some other convictions for forgery, theft, and prostitution. And when she was in prison, she apparently not just violated prison rules, but she threatened and assaulted other inmates. So I think there was like sort of a sense that she was preying on people that were like weaker and more vulnerable, that she was in effect the stronger person, and she targeted people that were weaker, vulnerable, elderly, or even other inmates that might have been weaker or more vulnerable.
Well, I've seen news reports that she worked as a physical therapist.
I haven't heard anything about that. I haven't heard.
Yeah, a physical therapist, and apparently, well, a physical therapist, there's either professional level of that where you get licensed and all that.
If you're non-Korean, you're pretty muscular.
Yeah, that's right.
And if you're Korean, you're not so muscular.
Okay. Well, if your work taking care of elderly people, mm-hmm, and helping them with their exercise, it would be kind of thing.
She apparently
had been accustomed to dealing with elderly and infirm people kind of professionally, and then she became a crack addict, and this all went crazy.
Susan, one thing I want you to mention, you said there were two murders. These were unadjudicated. Explain what happened.
Well,
the
prosecution would be able to call police officers that investigated it, and they would be able to have the officers testify as to their investigation.
Really like three murder trials.
Right. I mean, the police officers could testify to what they learned through the course of their investigation and obviously why they believe McCarthy was the person who committed the murders.
Even if the officers can put that into the record, mm-hmm, in the punishment phase, guilt or innocence already been, they couldn't do this in the guilt.
No, it had to be at the punishment
phase. But these cases were never litigated, and one wonders if the police officers were aware that she's killing these women, why didn't that result in charges and trials?
You'd think so, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Well, also the timing of it, I mean, you know, obviously if time had gone on further, it could have resulted in them taking her to trial on the other two cases, but in effect, you can only get death once, so.
And Ray, a factor you can't ignore, and I'm not saying this happened, but in the other two murders, it was black crime on a black victim. This was a black crime on a white victim, the later one. So, you know, and I'm not saying
that
was
the excuse. Yeah, but she was related to some of the other people.
That's right, because in the other two extraneous murders, this was black on black killings, and sometimes, especially in some parts of the state, that isn't considered a major offense. And they don't work at it as hard. I mean, that's just the way the real world works. And that's changed a whole lot since then. But back then, they weren't.
Back then, meaning 20 years ago?
Yeah. And this was the lady he killed, the professor, was a white woman. She was a black lady.
Okay.
So that might, and I'm just saying that did it, but that might be a very real bit.
Sure, you have to consider that as a possibility.
I mean, the state would likely pick the case that they have the greatest chance of getting a conviction and a death sentence on. And the case that they went on, the woman, it wasn't just that she was a white woman, she was a retired psychologist, and that her finger was cut off to get her wedding ring.
She apparently knew Kimberly?
Yeah, they knew
each
other.
Yeah. And so they probably went on the case that they thought, you know, would stand the greatest chance of getting a conviction and a sentence of death.
And this is Dallas County.
Yep.
Well, I mean, I think they would do the same thing in Harris County. They would go on the case that they have the best chance of getting a conviction and a high punishment on.
Okay, at what point in the appellate process did this business about there's only one black person on the jury come up?
Well, let me explain kind of how that all worked out. In the jury panel, there were four African Americans on the panel itself. The state struck three of the four, and only one served on the jury. But from reading the writ, and this did not come up, this only came up in a federal post-conviction writ. What happened at the trial level, when the state used their peremptory strikes to strike the three black members, there was no objection made. There was no what we call a Batson hearing, in which you claim racial prejudice, the defense lawyer does, and the state offers race-neutral reasons. That never happened. There never was a Batson.
Well, this was actually before Batson.
Well, there never was. You still have a Batson hearing. You could still do it then, yeah. But it just wasn't done. We didn't perfect the record on that. And what happened on, there was no objection made that the people were struck for racial reasons. And then what happened on the direct appeal, it was never mentioned. On the state writ, it was never mentioned. Now, what since happened is that we've had some changes in federal law in a recent case that said that you can say that your post-conviction writ lawyer is ineffective. It was never brought up on the writ. So what they've done in federal court, when that happened in federal court, they basically filed a writ in state court asking the Court of Criminal Appeals, because now, under a new ruling from the Supreme Court, you can now argue that your writ lawyer is ineffective. You couldn't at this time. This only came out this year.
Mm-hmm.
And the University of Texas Law Group went into federal court, went into state court, and are asking the Court of Criminal Appeals to look at the Batson issue. They're saying, and they're going back to the same things in the L. Miller Ray case. They're going back to the old DA's manual in Dallas. They've gone back, and what they've tried to argue is that the writ lawyer was ineffective because the writ lawyer who filed the state writ and filed the federal writ, same lawyer, never brought up the Batson issue in any of the writ process, and they're claiming that this is the issue that was pending.
The trial lawyer and the writ lawyer?
No, the two writ lawyer, and the writ lawyer in state court and writ lawyer in federal court.
Okay, yeah, one writ lawyer involved in two cycles.
Right, because you have a different lawyer trying the case, mm-hmm. different lawyer on direct appeal. But on the writ, you had one lawyer, and that was the same lawyer that filed the federal writ. Okay. So it was not brought up in any of those processes.
How common is that?
That's unusual, very unusual, because normally by the time you get to the writ stage, Batson would hit, and that was one of the things you would normally hit, because usually you always claim a Batson error, because in a Batson, let me explain Batson real simply to you. Batson, you got to do three things. Number one, you got to show that's one strike. Doesn't make any difference. One strike made by the state is done for racial reasons. Period. There are three strikes of blacks here. And when you strike three-fourths of the blacks on the jury panel, that's presumed that you're doing for racial reasons.
Okay.
And once you establish that, the state has then got to come forward with what they call a race-neutral reason. I didn't strike this person because he's black. I struck him because he was sleeping. I struck him because he had kids in the penitentiary, some race-neutral reason. And then the judge has got to make a ruling on whether or not that's a race-neutral reason. Otherwise, he can disqualify the strike. That's mm-hmm. a Batson hearing.
Okay.
That never took place, never transpired. And so they're trying to resurrect a Batson issue through the latest writ filed in the Court of Criminal Appeals, because they're saying the initial writ lawyer that did the federal state writ and the federal writ was ineffective for not bringing up Batson issue, which was pretty obvious because when you strike three-fourths of blacks on the panel, that's a pretty well prima facie case that you're done for race-neutral reasons.
These things get...
But see, L. Miller Ray, they argued the same thing I argued in L. Miller Ray, the one that was reversed out of Dallas County, that was the one that got the infamous DA's manual that said, strike all blacks, Dagos, Mexicans, where they could
think
And Jews. They said, as Miller said, you strike Jews, strike Dagos, strike any minority group, regardless of how educated they are, you can get rid of them. That was in the manuals.
And this was passed around people in Dallas.
Yeah. That's how they were trying
to be district attorney. Yeah. Whose other voices have we got in the show?
Mike,
what's going on? What's your piece of this puzzle?
Well,
Mike, get the phone.
Get the microphone, ain't you?
The part that I like to talk about is how I would handle that case as a defense attorney. The problem with this case, as also have already heard, the facts are horrible. When you try a case like this, you're not trying to win the case in guilt or innocence. You're trying to save your client's life. And the way you save your client's life is try to get the death penalty not to be voted on by the jury. The trouble with this case is how do you mitigate the problem? the classic way to mitigate it is to claim drug abuse. Well, the problem is drug abuse is not an excuse for a crime.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, drug abuse is a reason why people commit crimes, why people are afraid of people that commit crimes. But I want to ask you, what's the difference between somebody addicted on crack cocaine and somebody with a mental disorder who's got to take a psychotic medicine in order to keep himself normal? They both have got to keep drugs. But when you look at that person, do you judge him based on his drug-induced state or non-drug-induced state? When somebody's on a prescription medication, his normal state is high on drugs. So is he dangerous high on drugs? No. When he's off drugs, he's dangerous. But when somebody is normal, not using drugs, and does dangerous things on drugs, we make them a dangerous person. But the key to this is what kind of person are we executing? If somebody has got a drug problem, if we take the drugs away from him, does he then become a not a future danger? Because keep in mind, this is about future dangers, not about what happened. They're being punished for what happened. They're going to go to jail. The question is, are there future dangers to society that need to be executed? And I think that what I would have done in a case like this is try to point out what the person is like not on drugs. Because in prison, she wouldn't be on drugs. In prison, she'd been dangerous. When she's not on drugs, what kind of things has she done in order to redeem herself? So you use drugs not for the purpose of using drugs as an excuse, but use drugs as a way to show that is this person a continued danger to society without the use of drugs?
Well, I mean, see, I've got this strange idea that whatever Kimberly or anyone else that we execute has done, no matter how sometimes horrible that seems to be, that the execution is not about them and what they've done, but the execution is about us and what we do. And since our traditions is not to consider drugs and the influence of drugs as a mitigating factor.
But that's not true, Greg. We do. Drugs is, let me explain the difference. Voluntary intoxication, whether it's on alcohol or drugs, is not a defense. Let me give you an example. We've tried to argue for years what we call diminished capacity, that somebody, because of use of drugs, can't formulate the intent to commit a crime. That's called diminished capacity. And what they've said over and over again,
and that speaks to culpability.
That's right. That goes to culpability. So it is not an issue of guilt or innocence. And they'll say over and over again, involuntary intoxication is not a defense, meaning you can't do away culpability. But it may be a mitigating factor of punishment. The jury's so instructed, it could be a mitigating factor. And what Michael is talking about is using the drugs as a mitigating factor. And really what you want to do is the old Percy Forman trick, you put somebody else on trial. In this case, you put the drugs on trial and try to get Kimberly out of it. It's what you'd have to do in this case. But it is a mitigating factor, and the courts will instruct you that it can be a mitigating factor.
Okay.
So it's mitigating at punishment. It does not have anything to do with culpability. That's the difference.
Okay. Well, apparently, Kimberly, and women's death row is different from men's death row. Women who are at the Mountain View unit have more interaction with inmate population than the men have with the inmate population off of death row in the Polunsky.
Well, it's a small death row for females in Texas.
There's a few people there.
Well, there's only, Carla Faye Tucker.
Yeah.
And the other woman.
I think there are nine right now.
Okay, there's nine. Okay,
yeah.
But it's still, compared to males, it's
very small.
The percentage of women convicted of a capital offense is extremely small compared to males.
It's a small thing. But apparently, we haven't had any reports of Kimberly killing anybody while in prison.
Well, she's she did some stuff, and she was in prison earlier before her case got reversed,
case.
And she did some stuff then that showed she wasn't exactly
muscled herself around.
Yeah, she did some stuff, so. Yeah.
Well, apparently, she, as
didn't
the
have a
elderly women,
her, so.
That she would prey on people she considered to be weaker or more vulnerable, and she did the same thing in prison. Whereas, say, like Carla Faye Tucker, you might have seen many interviews with Carla Faye. I'm sure you've seen many of them. I mean, Carla Faye Tucker, certainly after she was convicted, before she was executed, in the appearances she made on TV, let's just say she sold herself very well. She was fairly attractive looking. She was a born-again Christian. She was very remorseful for the crime. She represented.
She made a believer out of the detective that found her out in center.
One thing I've done, I've asked Jack Lee to kind of discuss the difference, because if you recall, Carla Faye Tucker was the last one we executed.
Yeah.
And
well,
Carla
Betty Beats was somewhere in there.
But no, the last one I think was Carla Faye, if I'm not mistaken. They had a big outrage. Yeah. That was the one they had the big outrage about. That was in Carla Faye's case, they had the detective, they had the prosecutor all wanting her to sentence commuted to life.
And the detective.
But in this case, no one's come forward and done that. And I've asked Jack to look in. Why is there a difference in the way we're treating Kimberly McCarthy in the way we treated Carla Faye Tucker? What's the difference between the two? Because both of them committed, as you recall, Carla Faye Tucker was an axe murderer, killing mm-hmm. two people.
Not a pretty fact situation.
Both of them are ugly facts. But in one case, you have a lot of people, including prosecutors, police officers, and private citizens, begging for her life. And in this case, nobody's done that. And I was asked Jack to look into that and discuss that aspect of it.
Jack?
I think the reason here is, as Susan touched upon, you have one person here who is repentant, who feels very badly and has, in the case of Carla Faye Tucker, she found God, became a born-again Christian, and really didn't cause any real trouble thereafter. One could arguably feel sorry for her. On the other hand, McCarthy had so many things going against her. First,
McCarthy refused to give interviews like Carla Faye did. Is that right?
That's correct. Carla Faye, it seems like, if I remember correctly, Carla Faye Tucker would give an interview to anybody who's willing to listen. To a certain extent, I think she sold her repentance very well, whereas McCarthy has not done that at all. And as Susan said earlier, in her first go-around, she was abusive with guards, she caused trouble and picked on people that she thought were defenseless.
Vulnerable.
Yeah, vulnerable. Thank you for that word. We're more vulnerable. And yeah, I don't want to understate how important it is that Carla Faye, on the one hand, was a fairly attractive woman, and McCarthy, on the other hand, is not a terribly attractive woman. And, you know, we have, on the one hand, a very small, petite, small-framed white woman, and on the other hand, we have a fairly robust black woman. And it's, one is repentant, one is not, one is attractive, one is not. I think the equation was stacked against McCarthy in terms of public sympathy.
And Larry brought out some interesting stuff. I'm going to talk to Larry, if you don't mind. We were talking about this earlier. I thought Larry brought out some interesting stuff. We were talking about this. I want Larry to discuss, if you would, Ray, the racial factor in this, because I think we can't ignore the fact that in one case we have a black woman who's being executed, and it's not garnered the sympathy, and we had a white woman who's garnered. And I've talked to Larry, and I've asked him to look into that.
While you're at it, Larry, how can criminal justice escape what appears to me to be a very obvious indictment that it's so racially charged?
Well, race is always a factor, whether we want to admit it or not. It always is, and that's one of the reasons why, when Jim mentioned about the Batson, the lack of a Batson challenge, at least to consider the issue and allow the prosecutor, force the prosecutor to come forth with race-neutral reasons as to why the three blacks were struck by the prosecutor. Race is a factor, and in this case, distinguishing between this case and the Carla Faye Tucker case, it was not the only distinguishing factor, but it was indeed a factor. That factor cuts both ways, though. And while traditionally prosecutors believe that they need to strike blacks from the jury, and defense lawyers want to make sure that blacks are on the jury, particularly if the defendant is black. Mm-hmm. The fact is that it's a lot more complicated than that. Blacks can be pretty hanging people. I mean, they really can be really hardcore in terms of law enforcement. A good friend of mine, he's a defense lawyer now, but a prosecutor for a long time, Mark Vinson, was sharing with me a story
about Mark's black, right?
Yes, he's black. And he was sharing with me a story about a jury selection process he went through for just a regular felony where 60 people are brought over on the veneer panel and 12 were selected from that. He's, as a black man, he's seated at the table, the counsel table, and he see, as the veneer is coming in, is filing in, one of the panelists says to the other, "I wonder what the black guy did."
So they assumed that he was the defendant, even though he was the prosecutor.
Just because he was black, he looked around and he was the only black person at the counsel table.
Were those
table.
Jurors white or black? Did he go there?
That's the other part of the story. The other, he says, one didn't say to the other, "I wonder what the black guy did." He says, "I wonder what the brother did."
There was two black jurors.
There was two black
jurors talking to each other.
So they're talking to each other and they assume that just because a black guy is seated at the counsel table, he must have done something.
And this is the black juror assuming that ahead of time. So.
Lawyers, black or white, have to deal with
it. Maybe defense need. But we've got a report from Gloria Ruback and put her on. Gloria?
Yeah, hi, Ray.
Yeah, when last time we were talking to anybody up there, we could hear you in the megaphone in the background. So we knew you were busy on the picket line. What have you to say to us today?
Well, there's a lot of people out here. You know, usually there's 10, maybe 15 of us. And I guess there's 50, 75. I'm not very good. Maybe 100 people. I don't know. Have you counted?
Probably about 200, I would think.
200? Oh, hell, I don't know. There's a lot of people.
A lot of people.
There's people here from Houston, Spring, Dallas, Willis, Germany, and the wife of... John Quintanilla, who is the next person to be executed, is out here with us. The wife of Alvin Crane, who was executed, I think in 99, is out here with us. Just a really beautiful group of people who are angry and upset and amazed that 500 people have been killed. It's hot as hell. The people are standing out here and they've got, oh my God, they must be paying guards overtime big time. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. Shit.
Yeah, you can't say some of these words on the radio, Gloria.
Oh gosh, I'm sorry.
But the deal is, are these folks turning out for Kimberly because killing a woman in Texas is relatively unusual? Or do you think they've come because we've reached the a gruesome statistic of 500?
Well, I think it's a combination. It's the 500th execution. It's a woman. It's a black person tried by an almost all-white jury in a racist situation in Dallas County. So it's a combination. But probably just because of the horrible milestone that Texas has bestowed upon itself of executing 500 people.
Well, I happen to know that Gloria is closely associated with the Texas death penalty abolition movement. And I happen to know that their website is abolitionmovement.org. And when does the group meet and where?
We meet on the first Tuesday of every single month at the SHAPE Community Center at 7 o'clock. And SHAPE is 3815 Live Oak on the corner of Alabama and Live Oak.
And the very next Tuesday we have will be an occasion of that meeting.
Right. You know, it's really great to see people from the Dallas Peace Center, from the National Black United Front, from Death Row families who are here. Connie Wright spoke earlier. Her husband was an innocent man who was executed, I think, 4 years ago or six, I forget. The New Black Panther Party is here. And I don't know all the groups that are part of the Dallas Peace Center, but they've got some very... Oh, heck.
Well, Glory...
is that the press? Are you sure?
The press is coming out. Gloria?
Yes.
The press is coming.
Kimberly has been murdered.
Okay. Thank you, Gloria, for that report.
Dog. Okay. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Now, Gloria gets a little upset, and she starts cussing, so I've got to move along. I'd like to shift a little bit. I, 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 I don't know exactly. Larry, there's nothing we can do within the foreseeable future about the inherent racism in society that spills over into the delicate decisions of criminal justice. Or do you have a solution for the problem?
Well, we just have to deal with it, Ray. It's getting better. I mean, Jim raised the issue of whether prosecutors do continue to systematically exclude minorities from juries. And it clearly is not nearly as systematic or not as nearly as institutionalized as it has been in the past. And, well, in the not too distant past, I mean, a prosecutor was a white male. Now you've got more blacks and more women who are in the DA's office and then also defense lawyers.
And incoming jurors assume that they're the defendants, as
I mean. Let me say something to you, Ray, about this, what we can do in the future. And one thing, and probably a lot of people get mad at me for saying this, but I'm going to say it anyway. A part of the problem, I think, lies with the black community. Let me tell you why. People on television who serve on juries see all these rap guys talking about gangster raps, wearing their pants down to their bottom, wearing all that.
I thought that was advertising.
Well, I'm just simply saying, as long as that's tolerated in the black community, when they talk about being a gangster, they're going to be treated like a gangster. And people see that on television. It makes it very, very difficult for a defense attorney defending a young black man to get that image out of their mind, because you see, if you go to the courthouse and you have anybody go to the courthouse on any day of the week, you can see these kids coming down there with their pants down, with a bunch of jewelry, caps on backwards, and they sing these gangster songs, and they wonder why people think of them as gangsters. A part of it, I think, and I wish more black leaders, Bill Cosby came out with this. He talked about the responsibility of the black community to kind of make these, come of these kiddos not portraying a bad image. And if they sing about raping their sisters and talk about gangsters, why should they complain if people think of them as gangsters automatically? I think part of it's in the black community. I think the leaders should take a stand on some way these kids are acting, some of the music.
Do you know, I think some of the leaders do take a stand. I just don't think that they're getting much traction with that.
Bill Cosby did. Everybody jumped on him.
Yeah, so. I went up to Montgomery County to a JP court.
Mm-hmm.
To deal with a situation where a couple of frail Hispanic kids, 9-year-olds, small for their age, was bullied by an Anglo who was about twice their weight. He was 12 and large for 12. The parents of the two victims of that bullying incident ask the prosecutor to take sending him to jail off the table and submit him for evaluation and counseling. I wonder if the situation had been reversed and the smaller children were Anglos and the bigger children were black or Hispanic, if the parents would have asked the same consideration of the prosecutor. I have to wonder that. I don't know.
Because, you know, Chris Rock, if those of you who've listened to him, he's talked about the very same thing that I'm referring to. He makes the distinction.
No, that's out there in the discussion.
Yeah, and he talked about the difference, how black people dislike that group, and he called them the N-word. And he said, and he talked about how for example, if every juror saw people who dressed and acted like Larry, it would be a lot easier for us to defend young black men if they see some moron with his pants down to his knees talking about raping his sister. They see on television. And that image, that hurts. I'm just telling you, when you go to trial on that, that really hurts you, because you have a lot of these gangster rap people, and it makes all the black community look bad. And I think they've got to do something, too, to contribute this, doing away some of this.
I would like some feedback. There's a couple of things I'd like feedback on, because now I know that this show has become very popular in the regular units of Texas prison system. Before we went on the air, Jack Gillespie asked me a very good question. Mike Gillespie asked me a very valid question. What happens to the bunch of people who have been taken off death row and put in general population What are their lives like now? How do they get along with other inmates? And I want those of you who are in that situation, you've been on death row and now you're in general population. Mm-hmm. I want you to write me here at radio station KPFT. Don't put the prison show on the outside. Put execution watch on the outside of the envelope so that I can keep out of that 40 pounds of mail in the other room. Just put it to Ray Hill, execution watch, and let Elizabeth and I look over your letters and see if we can't find something to report out of that. The other thing I want to hear from you, and I want to hear from the people in the room. This is the 500th execution in Texas. So that means that we have executed about four times more people in Texas than anywhere else. I was listening to a radio discussion on a University of Houston-connected non-commercial station. And the advocate on that, who basically favored execution, said, Texas is a big state, and we've got a lot of bad people in Texas. So we have to execute more of them, and that's a normal thing. There's nothing wrong with that statistic. I don't believe that. I don't believe that Texans as a class, Susan, are any worse than the rest of the people in the country. They may be as bad, but I don't think they're substantially worse.
By the way, Mike disputes that 500 figure.
I don't
figure.
Know, Ray.
Yeah, let's hit, Mike, what do you mean?
The 500.
Well, it's kind of interesting.
Get close to the microphone.
It's kind of interesting. Even though the state has executed 500 people, the state set 512 for execution. But 12 of these men took their own lives in death row rather than have the state execute them. So even though the state says 500, this is really 512 people they have killed.
They have killed it. And you had something interesting saying about the cause of death.
Well, it seems to be a greater majority of them than you would think died of drug overdose.
Which is exactly what the state was going to do.
But the drug overdose they died with was not illegal drugs. They wanted to die so much they kept their medicine and overdosed on medicine, which is a drastic way to die because, first of all, the medicine is not healing you, so you're sick, and then you're overdosing on the medicine. Maybe that's the only way they can do what's civilized in prison, but I just thought it was unique, the fact that of the 12, the greater majority of them, the greater way they passed was self-inflicting of medicine they had hidden from the guards.
Okay, 512. Why have we reached this remarkable number?
Susan, I'm curious about something. I'm going to make sure it's mentioned. Sure. You asked her when you interrupted her. You live from Connecticut. What's the difference in Texas people and Connecticut people? Why are we killing so many in Connecticut isn't?
I mean, I'm sure they have statistics on crime per 100,000 people, which I don't know. I would basically say that there is more crime in Texas.
Than Connecticut?
Yes. Per 100,000 person, yes. Okay. I would say that's probably true. I would say, you know, the statistics probably would bear that out. In fact, I think there's actually more crime across the South per 100,000 per, you know, if you measure it.
Is that a Yankee talking, or are you just...
No, I actually think those are the crime statistics.
You know why, Ray? All the crime...
Well, you know, all this talk about crime, and now I'm the only criminal in the room. I'm the guy that's been actually sentenced
to prison. Well, we're lawyers. Don't say that. We could be criminals,
that's
too.
That's true.
Because we don't forget, most of the people in New York steal all your money. They don't shoot people. They just steal from them. They take all your money. It's for all the hedge funds people in Connecticut. So, go ahead, Susan.
No, I think they're probably... Also, I think Texas, in a way, is kind of unique in that it's a large state with a large population, and we also have a large number. I mean, we have, like, what five really large cities.
Well, I'm outnumbered here. I'm going to seek help, and we've got a criminologist on the line. Dennis Longmire, are you there, Dennis?
Yes, I am.
Okay, well, you want to join in this conversation of why... 500, and we figured out 512, counting those that have committed suicide before they get executed.
Right. Why Texas? Well, one of the things, I don't know if you've mentioned it, but if you look at the states that once embraced, and not only embraced, but strongly, strongly encouraged slavery, we fall into those states. Those states are the states that tend to have the highest rates of execution. And I think it all has to do with the historical ability for a group of people to be turned into something less than human by virtue of a law or a name that we call them. If they're a slave, they're not fully human. If they are black in the state of Texas, they commit a crime against a white person, it's a much more severe crime. Now, that's not statutorily the case, but socially and culturally, that's the case. And so I think that Texas is the product of its history, and the death penalty is a lingering and strong-held cultural power that it's going to take a long time for us to overcome.
Well, I mean, you know, it. I can see the interrelationship because a friend of mine, I forget her nom de plume, but she's Bernstein's, Alan Bernstein's wife, has written a book about the last lynching in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And I can see the coalition between executions and lynching. But then, Robert Pruitt is white, and we consider him lesser than human being too. If you look much into his trial and his crime, he's incidentally been stayed because there's been a hitch in that come along, and hopefully he will get exonerated. But he'll still be in prison because he was serving life when he is accused of killing that guard. But it doesn't have the racial overtones that the lynching had.
Well, and don't mistake me, I don't think that all of the cases involve that. But I still think every one of the cases does involve some transformation of the criminal into something less than human. And so in the case whether they killed a correct officer, if you read the stories that follow each execution, those stories portray the condemned as monsters or animals who need to be put out of our mercy. They need to be put out of our space because they're dangerous.
Mercy, now, I'm going to have to talk to John about his stories because,
yeah.
Because John Grazik is the one that writes the aftermath.
Well, and I respect John greatly. He does a good job covering the
tough territory,
the executions, but we very rarely hear much about the offender in any way that characterizes them in a human, sympathetic way. Maybe that's the media's responsibility.
Well,
maybe it's not. But
well,
I certainly wish that there was more attention given to the lives of these people that we execute and how they became who they are, so that maybe some insights could flash down on us and we might be able to avoid so much fatal violence in this state.
Dennis, you know, let me use this as an opportunity to ask our inmate audience. I've always put a great deal of faith in the information I got from inmates. You five guys are living down there. I used to, but do you realize that it's been damn near 40 years since I was in prison?
Wow.
And that place is very different from the place that I left. I want you guys to give me feedback. In first place, I want you to grow up and consider yourselves a real human being who is entitled to have an opinion. And I want you to write me and share with me. Don't be surprised if I don't write back. I'll send you a brief JPay thanking you for your letter and commenting on it. But I want your feelings about what we're talking about here today. I want your feelings about why Texas, why 512 people are dead because they were sentenced to die in Texas. I want to know why someone would rather take their own life than wait around for the warden to do it on the occasion. And recently we had one executee who said, "Wow, warden, thank you." Because
right.
He was enjoying the drugs yeah, that came down
it.
For the last few seconds of his life. And give me some feedback. This is the longer I'm at this, the more confusing it gets to me,
Mike and I were talking about this earlier. Mike, you were talking about one of the reasons we have so many executions. You're also another Yankee, so let's hear from the Yankee version.
Well, it's kind of funny. The purpose of criminal system is punishment. And I'm not saying this, you know, to be funny, but in the overcrowded conditions of New York, the way people live, being put in prison with a lot of people is a punishment that people understand. The death penalty is not a big crime up there. Down here, it's a big crime. But let's talk about why it's a big crime, because you said a very interesting thing that I'd like to talk to you about, Ray. Why have we had 500 all of a sudden? You make an issue that we've had 500 since the Supreme Court changed
the law.
Yeah,
but we had 450, 460, 470.
But I have a different factor. In the old days, you were executed at the county courthouse. Okay? In the old days, you were executed in the county courthouse where you committed the crime.
In the neighborhood, yeah.
Everybody saw it. So therefore, the only real moral justification for the death penalty is the detriment to commit crime. When people see somebody hung, like they did in the old days, they see it. It's a horrible experience. Now we're executing people behind
closed doors. What's going on in this room?
But we're executing people behind closed doors where the public doesn't see it. The purpose of a public execution is to deter young people from doing something to be executed. Plus, the horror of it makes people anti-death penalty. But now all it is a blurb in the newspaper, yeah. And thanks for your show, it's out here.
It's still Mike, every state's doing the same thing. There's no public.
Them in private.
Well, every state's doing that. Yeah, but still we have more.
The closest thing you have to public execution is what is happening in this room right now.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe that's why we have more, because it doesn't have the chilling effect that it used to have where people could see it and kids would never want to be in it.
The question is, why do we have more than other states? That's really the question.
If we have more serious violent crimes, like horrible murders, robbery murders, of course there's more fear in a society, in a community. And of course, you know, people have a reason to be more fearful because they see this. And I think they're more likely.
Right. Just as the discussion heats up and it begins to work like a real discussion, I've got to say time, because let me tell you, if you didn't know it, clock is God. This is Execution Watch. I'm Ray Hill. I am the host. We have killed Kimberly McCarthy today. She is dead. When the witnesses left, that was an indication the process was over and she had been killed. Her body will be taken to a nearby funeral home where her family will be able to touch her while her body is still warm. Gruesome, I know. Our lawyers, Jim Skelton, Susan Ashley, Larry Douglas, Mike Gillespie, and Jack Lee, those people are worth their weight in media gold because they make it happen. Our reporters from Huntsville today were Dennis Longmire, a new voice, David Rozicki, who is with KPFT's Evening News, and of course, Gloria Ruback, who's a regular feature. Dave Atwood reported from a vigil here in Houston. The next execution is scheduled for July the 16th. It'll be Juan Quintanilla Jr., and we hope that Juan gets a stay. His family attended this execution, and we hope that that we don't have to do that show, but it is now scheduled for July the 16th. It's Juan Quintanilla. Our producer is Elizabeth Stein, who worked very hard to put this show together, as she does all shows. Our technical director in the studio is Doyle. Doyle Odom has been our engineer tonight. Otis McClay is our wizard. And the theme music we played is from Victoria Panetti, whose brother is on death row. You can find out more about her at She Monster International or MySpace/She Monster. Thank you and good night.